You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio. WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Well, you could call them CSI Wildlife. They're fighting the black market in wildlife, an annual worldwide trade some estimate as being worth $20 billion. Our guest this afternoon reports that ounce for ounce, illicit products such as rhino horn and deer musk can be worth more than gold, diamonds, or cocaine. She says it is the third most lucrative criminal trade in the world, ranking behind drugs and human trafficking and in front of arms smuggling. Today we're going to look inside the world's first wildlife forensics lab. Our guest is Laurel Neamy. She's an international consultant specializing in natural resource management. She's also an environmental journalist and the author of Animal Investigators. Her book tells the story of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Forensics Lab in Ashland, Oregon. Listeners, I welcome your phone calls for our guest, Laurel Neamy. I look forward to your questions and comments for her. The number is in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-945-55. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Laurel Neamy has worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development and the U.S. Department of the Treasury. She's written for the Nature Conservancy and World Wildlife Fund. She also writes for the Earth Negotiations Bulletin. Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species, is published by Simon & Schuster. You'll find more about our guest and her book at her website, www.laurelneamy.com. And her last name is spelled N-E-M-E. Again, our phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Laurel Neamy, good to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Would you give us some sense of the range of illegal wildlife products that are being traded today?
Well, it really ranges the gamut from butterflies to birds, from turtles to tigers. If it's rare, people tend to want it and someone's willing to sell it.
And tell us what the lab's director, Ken Goddard, calls the shop of horrors.
Well, it's a part of the lab that they keep old evidence in that's been abandoned, and it includes a range of products from, a polar bear skin rug, to an elephant foot stool, to also what he calls the men's corner, which is a variety of products and pills and potions designed to help a man's impotence.
Yeah. And here in the book, at that point in the story, you say, tongue-in-cheek, maybe with a better word on the street about Viagra, our animals might do a little better.
Right. And that's true, because Viagra probably has more medical science behind it than,
yeah,
say, rhino horn or seal penis or bear paw, which are all used to, help a man's sexuality or as an aphrodisiac.
Mm. Is it possible for us to buy something without realizing what it is we're buying and how it was produced and traded?
It's very easy, and that's because the laws are very complex, so it's hard to know if what you're buying is legal or illegal. For instance, you might go into a shop, a government-run shop, when you're traveling, say, in India or in the Caribbean or Brazil or elsewhere, and something might be perfectly legal to be purchased there. Yet, when you cross the border, it may or may not need a permit, and it may be illegal to import it. The other thing, just as an example, I was actually in Washington, D.C. last week, and I was preparing a presentation related to chatoush shawls. And chatoush shawls are these beautiful sort of cashmere feel to it. Shawl is this huge shawl, and they're called ring shawls because they're so thin and so warm they can fit through literally a person's ring. It feels like nothing else, and it takes 5 endangered Tibetan antelope to make one of these, and you have to kill the animal. And it's illegal to traffic in these shawls. And my friend had bought this beautiful shawl in a government-run shop in India, and it may or may not be a chatoush shawl. It wasn't marketed as such, but it was called a ring shawl, and it was very expensive. In New York, a ring shawl could be worth as much as $15,000 to $20,000, and in fact, very high fashion New York, elite, including Christie Brinkley, have purchased that through auctions and very legitimate types of businesses. And it turns out that unless you have this lab to identify the species, you might not, you cannot tell just from the look of it or the feel of it whether it's a legal product made, say, from cashmere goat or from the illegal animal, which would be Tibetan antelope.
Yeah. So what's a consumer to do?
Well, it's difficult. And I think it's one of the safest things is if someone is marketing something as very rare and endangered, because a lot of times that adds to the cachet, to avoid the product if you want to avoid being part of the animal trafficking problem.
I'm wondering, you know, now here, what's the impact of this trade on wildlife populations and the larger environment?
Well, that's a great question, and it's hard to say because we don't really even know the size of wildlife trafficking because, as you had mentioned, experts estimate that it's worth about $20 billion a year, but really nobody's reporting their sales figures. So we don't know for sure, and we don't really know the volume of it, although we do have anecdotal evidence about how much particular cases, how many animals a particular case may have involved. For instance, just in March, there was a huge trafficking bust in Brazil by the Brazilian Federal Police together with Interpol, and it was the largest wildlife trafficking ring bust ever in their history in Brazil. And that case involved about 500,000 animals per year, and it had been going on over several years, worth about $20 million a year. And that was primarily in macaws, like parrots, and also other types of animals, including some jaguars and other animals. But each of these cases can involve hundreds of thousands of animals. And the problem is that it's plundering species already under threat and really least able to withstand the losses. Because overall, we're losing about 30,000 plant and animal species each year. That's roughly 3 species an hour. 1 in 4 mammals, 1 in 8 birds, 1 in 3 amphibians face a high risk of extinction soon. And that's not all from wildlife trafficking, but wildlife trafficking contributes to and hastens these trends.
Who is in this trade?
It really ranges from the one-off tourist unknowingly buying a product to a petty criminal who wants to make a quick buck, maybe by poaching a few animals, to bigger traders and also organized crime networks and even military juntas and international terrorists. There's been anecdotal evidence that even Al-Qaeda cells have been involved in trafficking ivory.
Because it's so lucrative.
Because it's so lucrative and the penalties are so low. So you often see, say, organized crime networks who already have a way of smuggling contraband. They can already move, illicit material in a hidden way, through hidden compartments, across borders. They have the financial wherewithal to hire poachers and to get the product and to forge permits and transport something illicit and hide it across long, long distances. And so for them, it doesn't matter that much what product it is, whether it's, you know, humans or drugs or wildlife, they'll still make a buck. And there's been a lot of evidence that, say, some of the huge ivory shipments that have come across have been in some of the same shipping containers that had previously been used for drugs and cocaine. And there's also a combination of hiding drugs in some of these illicit animals as well, and then also a link with human trafficking. In fact, that Brazil case I just talked about, it was discovered because the police were actually investigating a human trafficking ring, and some of these same people were also involved in wildlife trafficking, and that's how the whole case started.
Yeah. Well, given that kind of a link, is this kind of trade getting more attention now from the authorities?
I think the attention has still been relatively minimal. And in fact, that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is to call attention to it, because I think people aren't really aware of the extent of wildlife trafficking. And I'm often asked, what's been most surprising in writing this book? And truthfully, to me, it's been the range of products. Every time I turn around, there's some new product, you know, some new species that's trafficked that I never thought, why would anyone want that? And and really, I think people don't know. Congress did hold a hearing in March on this issue, March 2008, actually. So it's getting a little bit more attention, but it's still, relatively speaking, extremely low. And that's reflected, too, in the budgets for the law enforcement agency, the number of staff, and also in the penalties given for crimes against wildlife.
Yeah, that was something interesting to me as well to read you say in the book, let me think how you put it, that there one of the challenges for the forensics investigators is to keep up with trends and what's out there on the horizon, what's coming, like it's a fashion industry.
It is. In fact, one agent told me, you know, it's a fad thing. It's the new bling. It's really both in terms of species, where as investigators get good at detecting one kind of species or product, then traffickers often move to another. One example is with spotted cats and furs from spotted cats like leopards and jaguars and cheetahs. And traffickers have moved away from some of the larger cats towards some of the smaller mammals who have lesser protections on them. And so now you're seeing trends with species decline in some of those species.
What are the penalties today for trafficking in illegal animals and illegal flora, fauna?
Well, there are both state penalties and or federal penalties. So, of course, it depends on the law you're prosecuted under. But the most significant penalty that you could possibly receive is under the Lacey Act, which is a federal law. So it's a felony conviction, and the maximum sentence you'd get is 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Now, most of the time, it tends to be, you know, forfeit the material and a slap on the wrist or some lesser fine, you know, $1,000, $10,000, something like that. But you compare that to drugs, and drugs with possession with intent to sell cocaine, for example, is 20 years in prison and $1 million fine as a maximum penalty.
So we have a high payoff and not very much risk involved.
Correct. And the lab comes in and really does try and raise the risk and has succeeded significantly, because it used to be that traffickers, when caught, they weren't caught with blood on their hands. They were caught with a product that had been processed beyond recognition. So it was easy for them to say, oh, no, this is not a chatoosh shawl from a Tibetan antelope. This is a shawl made from cashmere goat. And unless you can prove otherwise, you can't prosecute a crime. You can't even say there is a crime. And, in fact, that also happened in 1989, after the international ban on commercial trade in ivory, you saw the spate of shipments of illegal ivory, with traffickers claiming it was mammoth ivory, which was legal, instead of modern elephant, which was not, and without a way to distinguish between the two types of ivory, because they look exactly the same, there was nothing customs could do, and they had to let it on through. But once the lab came up with a method to tell the two apart, then customs could seize the shipments at the border.
Yeah, and in this way, this is how this forensic lab differs from a forensic lab that deals with crimes against humans.
Correct. They're, human and wildlife forensics are similar in that both use science to answer a legal question. And both link a crime scene or a crime to a suspect and a victim. The difference is that wildlife forensics deals with 30,000 species, while human forensics deals with just one. And that means not only that wildlife forensics has an extra job of figuring out what the victim is, but for wildlife crimes, the answer to that question, what is the victim, what is the product, is key to even establishing that a crime occurred. And that's because the laws have some species which are protected and others which are not. So an ivory carving from a warthog would be legal, but one from an elephant is not. Or turkey feathers could be bought and sold, but eagle feathers can't. So knowing the species is key to even saying there's a crime.
So what was the impetus for creating this lab? How did it come to be?
It came to be because it wasn't that agents didn't have evidence against poachers and traffickers. They just couldn't find anyone to testify in court. And scientists at universities or museums who would examine the evidence typically refused to defend their results in court. And even if they had been willing, they didn't have adequate chain of custody procedures. And that would have opened up the validity of their analysis to questions of corruption or inaccuracies. And at the same time, human forensics labs had adequate security procedures, and they were used to testifying, but no human crime lab would justify working an animal case over a human one. So, you know, with time after time and case after case not being able to be prosecuted, they decided they really needed their own dedicated wildlife crime lab.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is Laurel Nimi. She's an international consultant specializing in natural resource management. She's also an environmental journalist, and she's the author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. It's a story, you could call it CSI Wildlife. In fact, it might make a good television show. Anyway, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, listeners, with questions, comments, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. So what does this laboratory look like? How many people work there?
There's about 35 people who work there, 24 forensic scientists. And at first glance, many of the rooms look much like a high school science lab classroom. But if you crack open one of the freezers in the corner, much like you'd have in your kitchen, you know, instead of seeing food and, you know, fruit, you'll see stacks of animal blood and tissue samples, which are used to differentiate species. Or you might enter the walk-in freezer off the evidence room, and inside on the metal shelves, you'll find bags and boxes overflowing with animal parts and carcasses, all labeled and waiting to be examined in their plastic bags. And then in the standards room, which is just a sort of a nondescript room with beige cabinets, file cabinets, like you'd see in any office, you slide open one of the 4-foot-long drawers, and inside you'll find 2 dozen skulls from adult and juvenile cats like cheetahs or leopards, or perhaps in another drawer a dozen large stuffed birds like scarlet macaws with blank cotton eyes staring up at you.
Hmm. What's the caseload?
The caseload varies, say around 600 to 700 cases a year, but each case might involve the identification of hundreds of pieces of evidence, or it might involve just one identification. But each of those pieces of evidence might also have within it several different types of products. And then within that, about 75% of the cases, the lab is asked to identify what species an item came from. And again, like I said before, that's because some species are protected and others are not. But to identify a species, it has to find what's called a diagnostic characteristic, and that's something unique to a particular species. And at first you think, oh, that's easy, I know what a bear looks like. But really it's easier said than done, because for each part of each species, that identifying characteristic might be different. So, for instance, for gallbladders, which are used in traditional Asian medicine, it's chemical analysis which discovers that it's the acids in the bile and the level of those acids. But for a bear's canine tooth, which are used as fetishes or ornaments, it's the lack of grooves on the side and a fine brown ring on the tip of the enamel. So for each part of each species, it's different, and it's a different process for finding that characteristic.
Yeah. You mentioned bear gallbladders and their place in Chinese medicine. What's the position of the Chinese authorities on this trade?
That's a great question, and it's changing. The Chinese, as background, the Asian black bear is endangered largely because its bile is coveted for traditional Asian medicine. And for thousands of years, the bile has been used to treat a variety of diseases like liver diseases and gallstones. And it's been found so effective that Western medicine has developed a synthesized form of the effective bile acid. But people tend to prefer the natural product. And so two things happened. One, people start turning to other sources of bears, like the North American black bears. And at the same time, China, South Korea, Vietnam, and other countries have set up hundreds of bear farms to harvest the bile from live bears, ostensibly to stop them from being hunted in the wild. But there are many questions about the milking process.
Yeah. Is there international cooperation?
There is, and there's been movements within China both to get away from bear bile and substitute alternatives, and also to try to make more humane the milking process itself.
Yeah. Well, the story of the bear and bear bile is one investigation that you cover in the book, Animal Investigators. Another is the walrus. Chapter 1 opens in a village in Alaska. A native Alaskan hunter has come across something very distressing. What had he found?
What he'd found, this hunter found, was headless walrus washed up on the beach. And it was one of hundreds that had been washing up on the beaches. And it was particularly disturbing to native hunters because traditionally, almost every part of the walrus is used. The meat for food, the intestines for raincoats, the skin for boats, and the ivory has always been a means of exchange and also carved for tools and crafts. And it's legal to sell them if it's for subsistence, and it's legal to kill them, I'm sorry, if it's for subsistence and not in a manner that's wasteful. And the case I talk about in Animal Investigators, hundreds of these headless walrus were washing up on shore, and the hunters were upset because they believed that the walrus gifted themselves to the hunters of their choosing, and that this sacrifice really represented an act of sharing and rebirth. And if you didn't respect the animals, they'd go away. So to see this waste, they feared that the animals would leave, essentially headhunted to extinction by the very people who depended on them.
So here we have a very sensitive investigation, a sensitive case, because we have politics involved and culture involved. and that was pretty delicate. How did the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensic Lab handle that? How did the Native Alaskans, who were distressed and wanted some assistance in figuring out what was going on, how did they come together and work together?
Well, it's an unusual case exactly because of that. And they really wanted someone from outside to say how these animals had been killed. But the question is extremely difficult because, like I said, it's legal to kill the walrus if it's for subsistence and not in a manner that's wasteful. And so taking the tusks alone, you know, may or may not be illegal. It could have been that the walrus had been lost during a hunt, or perhaps they died naturally and then washed ashore. And then taking just the heads would be okay, because it's just salvaging something, you know, the only thing that could be salvaged. You know, or the weather might have turned while the hunters were on the ice and they took the quickest thing they could. And that wouldn't be illegal either. But if someone shot the walrus solely for their tusks and didn't attempt to retrieve anything else, but could have, that was a crime. So the lab had to answer the legal question of whether the walrus had been killed for their tusks, and that was really discerning the intent of the hunter from the carcass on the beach. And so they started really by doing necropsies, which are animal autopsies on the walrus. And just getting to the carcasses was tricky. You know, the walrus had washed ashore over hundreds of miles of remote rocky beach, and the only way to get to most of them was by flying, and under the best of circumstances, beach landings are extremely difficult. The surface will change from day to day, so you don't know what to expect. So one day it might have small undulations, and the next what they call whoop-de-doos, which are 2 to 3 foot crests and troughs in the gravel itself. And as I tell an animal investigators, in the first year of this investigation, they were only able to examine 6 out of 61 dead walrus. Plus, the necropsies didn't provide the information they'd hoped, so they ended up having to find another way. And that's typical with this work of the lab, is a lot of trial and error.
Yeah. One of the people I want you to tell us about is Ed Espinoza. He's a chemist, and one of the things that you note about him is that he's a patient man. And that seems that this is a very important quality in this line of work.
It certainly is, because you have to be, you know, you have to be extremely patient, and they don't really get discouraged from failure, because every time they fail, it really tells them what doesn't work, which leads them closer to what does work. And they never know where they're going to find the next help for this their product. And in the case of the walrus, it turned out to be an observation in the carcass where a single carcass would rot. You'd have 2 stages of decomposition in a single carcass, and that was just strange enough to Ed Espinoza that he took note and started researching, you know, how a carcass decomposes and why you'd have 2 stages of decomposition in the same body. So, you know, the body itself was rotting as if it had been killed recently, but the neck bones where the head had been were bleached white, which usually takes a long time. And, you know, this stark white bone peeking out of this muscle was very strange. And so he started experimenting with what would bleach something white like that in a short period of time.
And what did he discover?
And he discovered that for that to happen, to have the 2 stages of decomposition, the walrus neck bones had to be exposed to the salt water, you know, and immersed for a period of time prior to washing up on the beach. And what that told them was that the heads had to come off prior to washing ashore. So it wasn't a beachcomber, mm-hmm. you know, happening upon a dead walrus. But even that, you know, it could still be legal to take the heads. So what they ended up doing was if you had these two stages of decomposition and these bleached neck bones, together with no other signs of harvesting meat or any other part of the animal, that would identify a walrus that had been killed illegally.
And one of the things that Espinoza did in the course of his investigation and thinking about how could this happen is he went to his butcher, right?
And he, correct. Because when he was trying to figure out about the bleaching, what would bleach those neck bones, you know, no one had ever done that before.
Yeah.
And so he went to his butcher and got joints, cow joints, from the butcher and experimented in first the Oregon beach and then eventually in the waters in Alaska. And he started by setting it up so that he had some bones immersed in the water for a period of time. And he fixed other bones at the tide line so that the water would wash over them intermittently. And then he had a third set of bones high on the shore, so it would be exposed to the air and wind, but not to the water. And he found that of those three examples, only the bones immersed in the water had that very, you know, bleached white look. The others still had, you know, bits of tissue attached and stained black from the tissue. And so from that, he still didn't know whether the results would hold in Alaska because that was in Oregon. So he had to do the same experiment in Alaska, and they did that in Nome and, you know, had the three sets of bones there as well and found that those results did hold. So from that, they could tell with certainty that the only way to get those bones bleached white would be to have them immersed.
And go ahead.
Yeah, which meant that the walrus had been killed on the ice and then their bodies had been in the water for a period of time.
Yeah. Now, this long and painstaking investigation confirmed what everyone suspected, that walrus were being headhunted for their ivory. What was the value, then, of this confirmation?
The value was in creating, you know, removing excuses, because at the time people were pointing to others as, you know, responsible for that. And even though the elders really knew it was coming from within, when you have excuses that, oh, it's the Russians on the other side of the strait and, you know, it's their hunters, or it's, you know, the Russian military using the walrus for target practice and they just wash ashore, by proving that that is wrong, it places the blame squarely on the native hunters. And that gave them sort of the power to take action and really work to change attitudes within the community. And they've done a lot of work on enhancing among especially the young people knowledge of traditional hunting techniques and traditional views toward the walrus. And in fact, you see that reflected now when hunters are turning other hunters in for headhunting. And you see the cases, you know, headhunting is still occurring, you know, poaching is still occurring, mm-hmm. but you now see other hunters turning those people in and identifying that, and it's not accepted.
Yeah. Also of great concern to the Native Alaskan leaders was that that if this continued, that they could lose their exemption for hunting the walrus.
Correct. The Marine Mammal Protection Act allows Native Alaskans to hunt walrus, you know, for subsistence and not in a wasteful manner. And so it's reauthorized every 5 years, or it changes, but about every 5 years. And if they were to lose that exemption, then they wouldn't be allowed to hunt. And even though, you know, their economies are coming more and more into the cash economy, and you do have satellite TV and electricity there, the culture and the people really still depend on it, both for subsistence and to supplement their income, which is minimal because opportunities are extremely minimal and all products out there are extremely expensive because it's difficult to get them there. But also it's a way of life and it connects them to their heritage. And it's something very deep and religious, and you know, they might not need it to sustain their bodies, but they need it to sustain their souls. And at the same time, as things are changing within their economies, you also have climate change reducing the numbers of walrus and the days that walrus can be hunted. The weather is changing. You have ice flows further and further away from the land, which makes hunting much more dangerous. So the number of days that people can hunt walrus is, you know, declining. And so successful hunting has been declining as well, and you see that reflected in both the amount of meat and walrus meat being used, but also just in terms of walrus skin boats, where a lot of people have been losing the ability to make these amazing, they're essentially huge canoes made with walrus skin, and it's vital for the deep ocean seas because they're flexible and you can haul them across the ice, and they can hold huge loads. So when you're whale hunting, you know, it can take a big hunting party and the meat and, you know, tow a whale back, and one whale can, you know, feed a village for a year. So, you know, to lose that ability to make these walrus skin boats because you're just not having the walrus and the success at hunting as you used to. So as things are changing, you know, they're faced with a lot of different challenges all at the same time, and you know, poaching is one at the same time as a change in their economy and climate change.
So a lot of different pressures coming to bear on native cultures and on wildlife species. How are these folks grappling with the question of what level of hunting is sustainable?
That's a great question, and currently, one of the main issues is that we don't really even know how many walrus there are. The last survey was in 1990, and there's currently was a survey done more recently in 2006 was when the flyovers happened, but the results have yet to be released. It's being analyzed, and it's a lot, the way this survey, the new survey is being done is a lot more accurate because you're able to count walrus in the water and on flows and across Russia and Alaska and all of that, but the results still aren't known yet. So until you know both, you know, how many animals you're dealing with and then how many animals are being killed and what the population can sustain, it's very difficult to answer that question. But you know, Fish and Wildlife Service and others are working on that very question. The numbers that Native Alaskans are killing is really very minimal, say 3,000 animals a year, 3,000 to 6,000 animals a year might be killed, and there's probably around 200,000 Pacific walrus. But we don't really know that number. That's a number from 1990, so I guess we'll see at the end of this year is when the survey should be out.
Our guest this afternoon, Laurel Neamy, author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. We have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the program. Listeners, if you've got a question, a comment, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So is this the only animal forensic lab in the world, wildlife forensics lab in the world?
It's the only dedicated wildlife crime lab in the world. There are other labs that do wildlife forensics, either attached to universities or attached to human crime labs. Like in Brazil, they also have a forensics lab that does wildlife products. And a lot of times what's out there has really been influenced by this dedicated wildlife crime lab. A number of countries are in the process of establishing their own, Kenya, Canada, Mexico, and they're using the Fish and Wildlife Service lab as an example. And the other thing that happens is that this dedicated wildlife crime lab develops the protocols and does the research on identification of different species and different parts. And with that, other labs can take those techniques and then apply them very easily because they've already been tested. They've already been tested in court. They've, you know, been verified and by peers, and so they hold up in a legal setting.
How does this lab determine what case to take? It seems like there's so many possibilities here. There's so much going on.
That's a great question, and they're authorized to take, you know, from state agencies, federal agencies, and also for all the signatories of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. So for 175 different countries, they can take that evidence. And they take it based on, you know, they tend to take felony investigations versus state misdemeanor investigations, and they tend to prioritize based on the threat to the species. So, you know, an endangered tiger would take precedence over a deer case. And that makes sense because it's also, as a dedicated crime lab, wildlife crime lab, it has the opportunity and ability to really push the science forward. And it does that virtually every day because every day, you know, a new type of part or product might come in the door or it might be processed in a different way. Just as an example, a bear gallbladder can be fresh, frozen, dried, crystallized, or powdered. It could be in pill form. It could be an ointment. It could be an alcohol. There was one case where a trafficker smuggled bear bile in whiskey, and the lab had to evaporate the alcohol off to find the bile, you know, or another in chocolate. And once the lab has ascertained how to analyze all this, then it doesn't have to actually do the analyzing in every case, but others can use those techniques very easily.
Mm. The third investigation that you take on in Animal Investigators involves the Amazon and Brazil. Feather art and the local peoples there. Can you tell us a little bit about that case? And here again, it strikes me that we have a situation where it's really important to work with the people who are living in a particular setting and are like the Native Alaskan hunters who they are relying on the environment to make their living, and yet they're being exploited.
That's a great point because it's not necessarily the use of the wildlife that's a problem. It's the commercialization, mm-hmm. sort of the rampant commercialization that causes a problem both for the species and potentially for the people at being exploited. And Animal Investigators tells how U.S. collectors of feathered artifacts ultimately spurred this huge trafficking ring in Brazil. And now, traditionally, Amazon Indians made these elaborate headdresses and armbands and earrings out of feathers and teeth for their rituals and ceremonies because they believed you'd adopt the characteristics of the animal you wore. So you might have this 2-foot-long red feather spiking to the sky, you know, connecting a shaman to the spirit world. And historically, tribes kept birds as pets and used the molted feathers, or else they captured them without killing them and plucked their feathers. But once collectors in Europe and the U.S. saw these, what they consider these very beautiful primitive art pieces, they wanted to display them and put them on their walls. And what happened was that started this underground industry where this gang in Brazil met foreign demand by essentially making, grocery lists of the animal parts they'd need, and then hiring poachers to go ahead and fill them.
Hmm. Amazing. One of the things that you wind up saying at the end of the book is, what needs to happen is we need to make conservation more attractive than poaching and illegal trafficking. Any progress on that front?
I think there is. I think there is getting to be a greater awareness of where products are coming from. You see it in a lot of different areas where you see it with organic food or with the no genetically modified organism movement or with local foods. You see it with fair trade coffee or a whole host of certification, certified lumber, where now you're starting to have the market being able to tell you what's produced sustainably and with the values which the consumer can hold. And I think consumers really have a lot of power. I think the issue is knowing where, what you're buying comes from. And I think certifications can really help a lot in, identifying sustainably produced products. I also think forensics has a role, too, because it can identify what species are included or engaged, and it can start identifying and distinguishing between legal and illegal products. And that ultimately helps the consumer. But truthfully, the consumer, the consumer has a lot of power because really, they're why traffickers are out there. And, on the flip side, one trafficker can have a lot of impact on a species because, just for example, in the, in the case in Animal Investigators on the Brazilian Amazon feather art, one person in one case was trafficking, thousands, well over 2,000 items were seized on the U.S. side, and well over 2,000 pieces were seized on the Brazilian side. And, each of those pieces is made with several different animals. There was one necklace made with 44 jaguar teeth, which means at least, one item, 11 jaguars were killed just to make a collector in the U.S. happy. And, so one trafficker can have a big impact on the animals, but the flip side of that is if nobody wants it, then they won't have the market to sell it.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Laurel, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laurel Nimi is the author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. You'll find more about our guest in her book at her website, www.laurelnimi.com. Her name is spelled N-E-M-E.